This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we've reached a milestone in America healthcare.
Health spending has finally topped the $3 trillion a year mark. That's approaching 20% of the nation's total gross domestic product. Just an astounding amount of money being spent per year on healthcare in this country.
It certainly is. And analysts estimate that it works out to about $10,000 per capita per year spent on healthcare delivery, about twice per capita what our closest competitors spend. The only problem is it hasn't changed the fact that the U.S. still ranks last among Western nations in terms of health outcomes.
Prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, annual health cost increases were in the double digits. Provisions in the law are aimed at keeping costs down, and we did see a dramatic drop in the rate of annual health spending over the past decade. But nevertheless, health costs still rise every year. And the question, what's driving these cost increases?
Well, Margaret, it turns out that prescription drug prices are a major factor. Drug prices for health consumers in the United States rose more than 12% last year alone, while the overall increase in health costs were about 5%. So clearly, drug costs are a major contributor to the overall health spending in this country. And it doesn't look like that trend shows any sign of abating.
Well, certainly another contributor to rising costs in 2014 was the increased number of Americans now covered by health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. And that is intentional. That took people out of the shadows of the uninsured and into the healthcare system. And over time, we certainly expect that access to preventive care and screenings and better chronic illness management will have a positive effect on overall cost trends.
No, I think it will. And increasingly, the kind of healthcare Americans encounter will have a technological component to it. Medicine has entered the digital age in the 21st century, something that our guest today finds both fraught with promise and cause for concern.
Dr. Robert Wachter is the founder of the Hospitalist Movement. He's a prominent medical educator from the University of California at San Francisco School of Medicine and the author of the critically acclaimed The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. He'll be talking about his concerns about over-reliance on technology as a panacea for America's health industry ills and the need to proceed with caution.
Laurie Robertson stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org, and is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chcone.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love hearing from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Robert Wachter in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. A million and counting. Open enrollment for next year's health coverage is marking some progress as we approach the end of the year. HHS Secretary Sylvia Burwell saying a million new customers have already signed up for coverage. The surge of interest before the end of December guarantees those who sign up by the 15th will be covered in time for the first of the year. Those who don't sign up by the end of open enrollment and remain uninsured face a tax penalty in the coming year. Some end-of-year penalties for several hundred hospitals across the country this year. Medicare penalizing 758 hospitals for raking in higher rates of patient safety issues. The fines to the hospitals total close to $400 million. The most common patient harm issues, higher rates of sepsis, hospital-acquired infections, and broken hips. Each year, Medicare also docks the pay of hospitals with too many patients coming back within a month and doles out bonuses and penalties to hospitals based on patient satisfaction scores, death rates, and other performance measures. Meanwhile, hospital officials are concerned these measures are punitive and take away funds needed to make the necessary patient safety improvements. And the Netherlands, not a country to shy away from smokable products, but they've had time to analyze vaping and have found a higher cancer risk than previously thought among e-cigarette users. The Netherlands considering a ban on anyone under 18 from being allowed to legally smoke or vape, as it's called. A recent U.S. study showed teens and young adults who vape are more likely to graduate to smoking combustible cigarettes than those who do not. The market for e-cigarettes is growing fast around the world as conventional smoking declines in response to massive public health campaigns and high sin taxes imposed on smoking. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Robert Wachter, Associate Chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Wachter coined the phrase hospitalist and is considered to be an academic leader of the hospitalist movement. A prolific writer on patient safety and healthcare quality, he's the editor of several journals, and he's written several books, including the latest, The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm in the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. Dr. Wachter, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me.
You say that we're at the dawn of medicine's computer age, but you caution that technology is neither the silver bullet nor the panacea that will fix what's ailing modern healthcare. And you say, despite being staffed with mostly well-trained and committed doctors and nurses, our system delivers evidence-based care only about half the time. You love medicine and technology, but you feel so strongly about the potential harm of the emerging use of digital technology in healthcare and why clinicians and patients alike should be concerned. Can you tell our listeners more about that?
For someone like me who studies patient safety, we've been waiting for computers for over a decade to come in and solve all of the problems of healthcare. And then when computers finally entered our world, and it's been remarkably recently, I began noticing funny things and doctors and patients not looking each other in the eye anymore and changes in workflow that were surprising. We didn't go down to radiology rounds anymore because we didn't have to. And so I've been thinking kind of a lot about what went wrong and what these changes were. And then about 2 years ago at UCSF, which is a fabulous place, we gave a kid a 39-fold overdose of a common antibiotic. And at that moment, I came home and I said, I need to understand this better and then need to write about it. And the challenge, of course, was writing about it in a way that doesn't dismiss the technology, but really looks at the moment that we're at in healthcare and asks, why is it not reaching its potential?
Share with us how people come together after a sentinel event like that to say, how do we make this technology work for us?
In some ways, it's easy to point your finger at Epic, Cerner, Athena, whichever company built your technology and say, they need to fix that. We came to realize that there were a series of policies that we created when we implemented our computer system that were perfectly well-meaning and work reasonably well most of the time, but in this case, it made the work more complicated than it needed to be. We also came to realize the system of alerts, which sounds like a great idea. This is one of the great promises of technology. When I'm about to write for a medicine that a patient's allergic to, the thing's going to pop up and show me, you know, the patient's allergic to this, don't do this. But we find that we have hundreds of thousands of alerts going off a month just within the computer order entry system. Mm-hmm. Add in the alerts in the rest of the system. No one has flipped the classroom here and looked at it from mm-hmm. the standpoint of what is it going to feel like to be a doctor, a nurse, or a pharmacist in an environment where you're getting alerts every 2 minutes. And the answer is you're going to ignore them.
Right.
And then there were other issues that involve culture, which is a young nurse sees an order for 39 pills when the correct dose is one and says to herself, this is really weird, but I know to get to me it had to go through a doctor and a nurse and a pharmacist, a pharmacist and a doctor, and I'll check it with my technology. And so she barcodes it, and that by that stage of the medication process, the barcode's job is to defend the order, and the barcode confirms that that's the correct order. So we had work to do on trying to convince people that when your spidey sense tells you
right.
that something seems really kind of bizarre,
right.
trust it. Don't over-trust the technology, and don't hesitate to pull the cord and say, it's time to stop the assembly line. Let's ask a question here. So these are, in some ways, predictable problems, but I think for many of us in healthcare, they surprised us, and we're just beginning to address them.
Mm-hmm. You've talked and written about the High Tech Act. You have some real concerns about the High Tech Act. Was it too much money all at once? Where did we go wrong?
The High Tech Act is actually an amazing backstory. In 2004, President Bush announced in the State of the Union address a federal goal of computerizing the healthcare
yeah.
system. In healthcare, there are differences that made it such that healthcare was not going digital on its own, but the initial budget to do that was $42 million. So that's to try to transform the $3 trillion healthcare economy. That's like trying to change the direction of a battleship by sticking your feet in the ocean and kicking hard. It's not possible. And then what happened in 2008 was the economy imploded, and they were coming up with a $700 billion stimulus package to revive the economy, and some smart health policy leaders said, here is our one chance. It will last for about 5 minutes and then go away forever. That was high tech. So that was the $30 billion of federal incentives that got us to go digital. And I'm actually not critical of those decisions, nor of high tech. I think the idea of a federal incentive program to try to push us over the line, to hit a tipping point where doctors and hospitals would go from analog to digital, I think was smart. It was happening on its own, but unbelievably slowly. And I think it has worked. So we're up to 70% EHR adoption in hospitals and doctors' offices. We were at 10% 6 years ago. Where I get critical of the government here is when HITECH was passed, they quite sensibly said, we better have another set of policies that ensure that people just don't accept the federal money and stick the thing on the shelf. And so we're going to create another set of policies that's called meaningful use. So basically, if you were going to give you federal money, you need to demonstrate that you're using the computer in a meaningful way. That's not silly, because the risk was real. But what happened with that was the federal government got very deeply into the weeds of essentially prescribing what your computer system should and shouldn't do. A lot of that is not okay, and I think we're in the weeds now. You know, there's a model of the feds getting this right, and the model is the internet, where in the early days, the internet was invented by, you know, federal researchers with federal dollars, and then they realized very quickly that it's time for us to pull out, and it's worked spectacularly well. The market forces through the ACA and other mechanisms that are driving healthcare systems, to me, are good enough that if you have a computer system, you will tweak it in the ways you need to meet those ultimate goals.
It is a fascinating area, and we've had the pleasure of talking over the years with David Brailer and Dr. Blumenthal, Dr. Mostashari. Meaningful use was the first phase of it, a tremendous boon to practices who were trying to shoulder the cost of implementing electronic health records, really helped get people out of those paper charts and onto an electronic health record. It doesn't seem to me it's likely that your average independent small practice can meet meaningful use 2 or 3. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on that and sort of the gains and the losses when we do that.
I think there's a general bias in federal policymaking that healthcare should run more like a business, and the set of incentives that allow the creation of a Google or an Apple or another high-functioning company tend not to be in existence in healthcare. And if they were in existence, they would drive toward larger, more system-y kind of organizations with better use of data. I'm probably a little bit biased because I live in San Francisco, and where Kaiser Permanente is such a dominant system, and I think works pretty well. I mean, I think that the model of a true system of the doctors and nurses and hospitals and all being part of the system, getting a dollar and distributing it as they see fit to deliver the best outcomes at the lowest cost, I think that makes more sense as an organizational principle. I guess my hope is that with new IT tools and with an increasing focus on the metrics that we care about, that there will be a way to create sort of the best experience for patients in the context of the benefits that a larger system can bring. Increasingly, people will get some of their health care, or maybe a lot of their health care, from their home or their workplace, enabled by new technology tools or telemedicine. But it all has to fit together in this pretty complicated jigsaw puzzle. And I think it's more likely that we'll succeed in achieving the goals if people are glued together in larger systems.
We're speaking today with Dr. Robert Walker, Associate Chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Walker coined the phrase hospitalist and is author of the Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. You know, you make an elegant case for the emerging healthcare system that's not only based on man versus machine, but rather on two elements working together in tandem. Tell our listeners more about where the medical profession might be heading in our newly wired world.
I had this epiphany a year and a half ago that I needed to write about this, but I'm not a techie person at heart, and so my wife is a journalist who writes for the New York Times, and she suggested to me that the only way I was going to get this right was to do it journalistically. And that meant I interviewed about 90 people, including all the Office of the National Coordinator Directors who you just cited, and went to see primary care docs doing their work in Dubuque, Iowa. But when I asked them, where does this all end up if we get it right? The vision that almost everybody had was about the same, and it was actually quite nice. You know, patients are getting digitally enabled care in their homes and their workplaces. We're using big data. Technology brings us closer to patients and brings patients closer to each other. So I profiled one of these peer-to-peer sites called Smart Patients, where patients get a diagnosis with cancer and they go on the web and they talk to other patients with the same cancer and they learn a tremendous amount from that. This sort of man versus machine, I think, is in some ways an artificial argument that when you get it right, it's not, these two are not in competition. These two weave together in new and wonderful ways. And I think it takes 10 or 15 years for the technology to settle into a new industry and make things really measurably better. We're at the stage in healthcare where I think we brought in the technology and we didn't reimagine the work. Or why shouldn't it look like Facebook or Twitter, where there's sort of a stream of information that everybody contributes to, including the patient? I don't think we've thought deeply enough about what are our goals and how does this technology help us reach those goals.
I think we'd be remiss, given your leadership in the area of developing the role of the hospitalist, in not giving an opportunity to comment on that as well, because certainly for a generation, but it was really physicians who were disrupted by this in primary care and in community medicine, spent years and decades in many cases with the hospital as kind of their daily social milieu before they went back to the relative isolation of their practices. And the hospitalist movement, as it developed, for all the very good reasons it developed, really was a big dislocation. What's the jury verdict on the gain and the loss around the almost complete transition now to the hospitalist movement around the country?
I have a strong belief that the organization of care with a separate hospital doctor achieves more gains than losses. The old notion of your doctor, your regular doctor, taking care of you in the hospital is attractive in all sorts of ways. But in the era of patients who are in the hospital being really sick, the pace being incredibly fast, I think you need a doctor there all day long. And my model for this, when I coined the term and kind of began thinking about this, in the old days, there were no critical care doctors. And then people realized that you need a physician, a generalist physician, who's essentially a specialist in the place. And ultimately now the hospital has become as complicated a place. You can't have a patient being managed by someone who has a different job 10 hours of the day. I think the data say that on average, quality and safety are at least neutral, if not better. Where I think things really get exciting is the maturation of the hospitalist field, because what we did was position the field as being a new kind of doctor, a doctor who would not only take care of the individual patient, but also be a steward of the system and pay a lot of attention to this other sick patient, meaning the healthcare system. And as I look at my group at UCSF, we are the unquestioned leaders in the organization in improving the system. It's not a coincidence, I believe, that the Surgeon General is now a hospitalist and the top physician at Medicare is now a hospitalist. It's a young field, but I think we have bred a disproportionate number of leaders in these areas because we have a deep belief that we did need a different kind of physician who paid attention to improving the system as well as individual patient care. But it means we have to pay a lot of attention to how do we move information back and forth, but in a good system, people actually speak to or email each other to make sure there's a personal connection. When I look at a high-functioning multi-specialty group, when I look at Kaiser Permanente or Geisinger or Palo Alto Medical Clinic, I think what they've done is they have created environments in the ambulatory setting where physicians get much of that joy and benefit and collegiality. So I think it's in some ways another argument against the one- or two-person practice. I think we need larger organizational units to kind of reimagine and the environment in which physicians will get that kind of professional benefit.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Robert Wachter, Associate Chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, Chief of Hospital Medicine and Medical Services at UCSF Medical Center, and author of The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. You can learn more about his work by going to the-hospitalist.org. Dr. Wachter, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
It's been a great pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Do the vast majority of Americans support defunding Planned Parenthood? That's what Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina claimed. But national surveys actually show the opposite. Most Americans support continued federal funding for the group's health services. The controversy over federal funding of Planned Parenthood has come in response to undercover videos taken by an anti-abortion group that show Planned Parenthood officials discussing compensation for fetal tissue with people posing as employees of a company looking to procure tissue for research purposes. Federal funding for abortion is restricted by the Hyde Amendment to only abortion cases involving rape, incest, or endangerment to the life of the mother. At Planned Parenthood clinics in 2013, abortions accounted for 3% of the nearly 10.6 million total services provided by the group, according to its annual report. We found several public opinion polls that found most Americans surveyed support continued funding for Planned Parenthood. For example, a Pew Research Center poll conducted in late September found that 60% said any congressional budget deal must maintain funding for Planned Parenthood. 32% said that any agreement must eliminate such funding. A Reuters Ipsos poll released in August found that 54% supported federal funding of Planned Parenthood, with 26% opposing it. A USA Today Suffolk University poll from late September found that 65% of those surveyed said federal funding of Planned Parenthood should continue, while 29% said it should be eliminated. And there are other polls with similar findings. We also consulted Marquette University's Charles Franklin, a polling expert who runs pollsandvotes.com, to ask if he knew of any national polls that supported Fiorina's claim. He did not. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Pregnancy is normally an exciting time for most women, but according to the research, an estimated 10% of prenatal women experience some kind of depression during their pregnancy, and many are reluctant to treat their depression with medication for fear of harming the fetus.
In fact, a higher percentage are experiencing lower grade depressive symptoms, so they might not meet full criteria for a major depressive episode, but they're having significant symptoms that are getting in the way of feeling good, perhaps even getting in the way of engaging in the kind of healthy behaviors that are going to support a healthy pregnancy. And left untreated, those mild to moderate symptoms can progress and can lead to a more serious postpartum depression.
Dr. Cynthia Battle is a psychologist at Brown University with a practice at Women's and Infants Hospital in Providence. She and her colleagues decided to test a cohort of pregnant women to see if a targeted prenatal yoga class, which combines exercise with mindfulness techniques, might have a positive impact on women dealing with prenatal depression.
We worked with these experts to really come up with a program that was similar to what you might find in the community of prenatal yoga that would include physical postures, meditation exercises. And we enrolled 34 women who were pregnant who had clinical levels of depression, and we measured their change in depressive symptoms over that period of time.
Not only were women able to manage their depressive incidents, they also bonded with other pregnant women during the program and found additional support from their group.
So we found that women on average were reporting that they were reporting much less. Women who are depressed during pregnancy, unfortunately, do often have some less ideal birth outcomes. So one thing we're interested in seeing if when we provide a prenatal yoga program, can it improve mood? And then can we even see some positive effects in terms of the birth outcomes?
A guided non-medical yoga exercise program designed to assist pregnant women through depression symptoms, helping them successfully navigate those symptoms without medication, ensuring a safer pregnancy and a healthier outcome for mother and baby. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.